This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
First of all, I'd like to congratulate Ulrika and the other editor, David
Hillman,
For this wonderful collection of essays that that treats a very important subject. I was delighted to read them all, and I think it's an ambitious project, not only because it sees the representation of body across different historical eras. So the first essay begins with Middle Ages and then the Renaissance up until the 19th century and the 20th century. But also it tries to cover as wide a range as possible, both in terms of theoretical treatment and in the manifestations of body in literature. So from what I see in each essay, the author really tries to cover as much literary material as possible. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to summarize very briefly a few hypotheses in the introduction, and then I'll ask you to speak a little more about your original project. So your hypothesis is that the body is notoriously difficult to theorize on its own. It resists conceptual definition. Literature, to take the two words in the title, on the other hand, does not give answers, but it portrays the nuances. So the true goal of the book is to show, I quote you, how the immediate materiality of the body, and I insist on the word materiality because you said at some point it's not so much about the body of image as in Baudrillard or in other theorists, but you really insist on the immediate materiality of the body can be presented in literature. But also conversely, how the body itself can be written and marked by the ideological and socio-historical forces. So my first question is actually a very, very general question on the origin of the project, because I do sense, I'm trained in literature, so I do sense there's this kind of ambiguity with literature. It's definitely a book of defense of literature, but on the one hand, literature is situated at the opposite side of what you call the medical, the scientific, the technological advances. On the other hand, you say that our understanding of the body is increasingly marked, shaped by these scientific discourses. Okay. On the one hand, you seem to see literature as the ultimate agent that can free the body from these scientific discourses. On the other hand, the goal seems to redeem literature from its debased status. I would quote you, you use words like literature as a waste product, non-normative body, a leaky vessel, etc. So there's something, could you tell us a little bit about this antithetic, if not paradoxical, relation that literature has with other discourses?
Yeah, okay, good. Thanks very much for that question. I suppose the project really began by being informed by phenomenology. It's not a book about phenomenology, but it began as a project that was informed in particular, I think, by Merleau-Ponty's thinking. Maurice Merleau-Ponty, the French phenomenologist, who in 1945 published Phenomenology of Perception, which continues to be, I think, the most important theory of the embodied subject. And Merleau-Ponty posits two different kinds of modalities of the embodied subject, or modalities of the body, really. well, the subject, first of all, is always embodied. There is no world for us. There is no subjectivity for us without the body. This is Merleau-Ponty's main premise. But the body then in itself has a kind of, well, has two different kinds of modalities. One is the habitual body, which is a pre-reflective body. It's the body that, in a sense, thinks for us. It's the body that's in operation in our everyday actions. So we can be driving a car or cooking or performing some rather complex motor activity, while at the same time, very, very fluently, without any problem, while at the same time, say, thinking about the work of Nietzsche. So the body does all this knowing. The body has this, you know, intelligence of its own, I suppose. And that's the habitual body, or what Merleau-Ponty also calls the body image. On the other hand, there is also the present body. The body as the body that is different from day to day, that is perpetually in flux. So we all have this experience of waking up in the morning and feeling out of sorts, or feeling particularly well, or feeling energetic, or tired, or hungry, or headachy. And one never knows how the body is going to behave, the present body. So that these two different modalities of the body do not always coincide, and in fact they never probably fully coincide in us. So that on the one hand, I have this sense of, in a sense, who I am and who I expect to be through my habitual body. Let's say I'm the person who plays the piano very well. I don't actually, but who plays the piano very well or plays tennis extremely well. But then one day, I do it really awfully. I just simply can't make it work. And that's when my present body and my habitual body are most out of sync, as it were. And of course, this is very pronounced in, say, illness. Because in illness, I have a sense of who I am and what my abilities are. But when I'm ill, I simply can't perhaps even get out of bed. But I certainly can't perform my daily routines. And so for Merleau-Ponty, any change in our bodily abilities or any change in our perceptual abilities causes a change in our subjectivity itself. We are not the same person when our bodily abilities change. And that's fundamental for him. And sometimes very little readjustment is needed because the body repairs itself and returns pretty much to its sort of norm, as it were, this habitual sense of being. But there are times when, say in aging or in very serious illness, when that's no longer possible and one has to, as it were, renegotiate a habitual sense of being. So I suppose the body is, that's a long way of saying, the body is unruly. It's something that we can't master. It's something that can't be mastered from the outside either. It is. It questions boundaries. It is. In many ways, this was what interested us. The body is, in many ways, a kind of radical entity, radically material entity. But also radical entity in that it is not easy to control. And it has a tendency to, let's say, for instance, we have a chapter on the maternal body. And the maternal body has leaky boundaries. And it swells in all kinds of culturally ungainly ways, what culture would perceive to be ungainly ways. You know, body fluids come out of it. What is one turns into two, so it questions this idea of, you know, the subject and its integrity, and various other ways. So we started to think about this in relation to literature, because literature too is a kind of radical mode of expression, and literature too is a kind of, is something that is always avoiding categorical definitions. Things are never black or white, but they're somewhere in between, the shades of grey. And so the body can deal with the complexity, we thought, of embodied experience better, perhaps, than any other form of discourse, at least. And that was our starting point, how, in a sense, that literature is perhaps the body's closest companion. And then we began to think about how there was no book on this topic, and there was no book that, as it were, traced or that historicized the body, as we do from the Middle Ages to post-humanism, post-human bodies. No book that also covered various thematic approaches to the body and then also various theoretical approaches to the body. And so we had this idea of putting together such a book. In fact, there are numerous monographs on the body in literature, but there has been no companion, no survey, no overarching theoretical book until now. There have been various books on the sociology of the body, body and gender, various other things, but not on literature and the body as such.
Yes, maybe one can say that what you aim at and you succeed in doing is covering a huge field from the medieval to the contemporary and the future. And I learned a lot from, I just sketch a few of the titles, and you have the list, but issues of the medieval body in Dreams and Fabliau, or disability in the medieval and Renaissance moment, or issues of sexuality and sexology in the 19th century, the aging body or the dead body, the racialized body, technology and the senses, the psychoanalytic, and we return maybe to the psychoanalytic body, the post-human body, and also staging the body, because it seems that if we consider literature as a sort of continuum, we have generally the impression that the visibility of the body is a modern thing, that it came maybe with people like D.H. Lawrence or all the trials for obscenity and so on, whereas in fact we realize that it was already there, or it's been there for a long time, but differently. And for instance, for my part, I loved the Fabliau, those French let's say popular tales. In there is one in which you have a couple dreaming of bodies covered in penises, and it's absolutely hilarious. And of course, if we think of the Renaissance, someone like Rabelais, the body farting, eating, pissing, shitting is there all the time, and we forget that a little bit. But maybe we have new modalities of thinking the body today. Would you?
Maybe I'll just jump in, because I was going to ask a question. I was very struck by a lot of the themes. If you just look at the titles, like the aging body, the there is one piece on eating and obesity, there's one piece on the body, pain and violence, and there is one piece on disability. So I was a little bit wondering, consciously or unconsciously, there is some kind of emphasis on pathology, but or pathology in quotes, because it's a word that we can discuss. But your introduction kind of clarifies that, because I think what you do want to portray is what you call a radicalized body in relation to the normal body. You know? So that kind of explains this gap, or the project, I don't know if it's conscious, but it radicalized the body in a way.
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, there are also chapters on things like language and the body, which is not a pathology in any way, or the maternal body, which precisely argues that, in a sense, the body, the maternal body, has been pathologized, but it shouldn't have been pathologized. It's currently medicalized. It shouldn't have been medicalized, you know, and so forth. But and talks about the curious kinds of beliefs and associations that have been related to the maternal body, how the maternal body has, for instance, been seen as subject to mental illness and various other kinds of illnesses when, you know, this isn't necessarily the case. So in a sense, many of these chapters also argue against pathology. Mm. There's a chapter on literature, technology, and the senses, and that really argues that, in a sense, the first technology, if you like, is literature, because literature is the first kind of medium that simulates sensory experience. So we talk about all kinds of virtual realities and things, but literature always already simulated sensory experience. So it talks again about how literature has this affinity, as it were, with the senses, and also with staging the senses, with giving us a way of conceiving of the senses ourselves. In terms of things like the aging body, I suppose, Elizabeth Barry writes about the ways in which we conceive of old age in terms of binarisms. There's either sagacity or foolishness, for instance, that the old age seems to elicit precisely this kind of dualism, you know, either a very favorable response or a very negative response. And she draws on Simone de Beauvoir's ideas of old age, which themselves are indebted to Merleau-Ponty's ideas again of how one's present body doesn't coincide with one's habitual body. She also talks about Catherine Woodward's writing on the body. Catherine Woodward has said that old age is like a second mirror stage, where one doesn't feel like the image that one sees, one to one's horror realizes oneself in the kind of negative image of oneself that one sees, that one's habitual body is not in sync with the aging body that one sees in the mirror. She writes about the extraordinary way in which especially modernist writers have often imagined themselves as aging, even when they have been quite young. So it's quite striking that someone like T.S. Eliot wrote his famous poem on the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock. He began to write it when he was 22 years old. So he was imagining himself as a middle-aged, balding man who's wearing his trousers rolled and whose kind of sexual life is already over. And so that there's something about literature, again, that has this ability to, or this curious capacity to identify with states not necessarily one's own, I suppose. Of course, Eliot's depiction of aging is not very positive, but there are other positive examples in Elizabeth Barry's essay on, you know, the kinds of different ways in which one might reconceive of the aging body.
I was mentioning earlier when we were chatting, there's a wonderful essay here by Maud Elman, who teaches in Chicago, and she published 20 years ago a book on hunger. A colleague of mine in the English department reviewed the book and imagined that she must be anorectic, which is not at all the case. And now, 20 years later, she returns to the fat body and what it means to be fat. And I'm sure that the next review will imagine that she's a fat writer. She's not fat either.
Not at all.
But it's a very funny essay on eating, obesity, and literature. And she has interesting parallels between the thickness of the books of the 19th century and the 20th century, and a certain type of body that is imagined there. And today, what she called a dietary fascism, that novels tend to be skinnier and skinnier, and a certain minimalism, because people don't want to be called being looking fat anymore. And I think all this shows that there's an imaginary body that is produced, but literature can explore what resists it, generally. And I think that's a very well analyzed by Andrew Bennett, who uses Derrida's insight into the repression of language as material in order to reach the meaning, sort of metaphysical repression, and something that shows that, in a way, bodies, by definition, are opaque and maybe do not make sense unless we make them make sense. And that may be the aim of literature. At least this is also what you suggest in your own essay when you try to talk about neurology and in a way, the not only neurology, but the imagining, a new imagining of the brain. Do you want to say a few things about your own essay?
Yeah, I suppose yes, my essay starts with the end of the 18th century and Franz Josef Gall's localization of various mental functions in the brain, or various other functions as well. And of course, most of those he gets wrong. But there is one function that he localizes in the brain, and that's language. And of course, this generates phrenology and various other kinds of disciplines, or sort of problematic disciplines. But what happens in 1862 is that Paul Broca is actually able to prove that the language area is on the left frontal lobe of the brain, as it were, left ventroposterior region of the frontal lobes, and that this is a momentous discovery. He's an aphasiologist. He has patients who have aphasia, and he has one particular one whom he treats for long enough to be able to perform various tests on him, and then this patient dies, and he's able to autopsy the brain and find that there are lesions on the brain. And the momentous discovery, it's momentous because it, for the first time, conclusively materializes language. So for the first time, you know, there is absolute certainty now that language isn't a metaphysical function, some kind of a performance of the self by the soul, but rather that language is a material function, it is a bodily function that can very easily be, as it were, damaged or impaired. And, of course, literature has to react to this. It has to do something, because its medium, language, has now been revealed in a completely new light. And my chapter looks at the ways in which not only this, but also 19th century nerve theory gives us a new sense of subjectivity. Because what 19th century nerve theory revealed was that things like reflexes are not under the control of the intentional mind, but rather they function regardless of our intention, regardless of any sense of will or intention. But rather that they react to stimuli from the outside world. So things like digestion or these are life, you know, absolutely vital life functions. And we can't survive without them. But yet, somehow, they don't seem to have anything to do with the rational self. And so this new kind of notion of the self begins to develop, where someone like George Henry Lewes, who was George Eliot's partner, begins to argue that the body has an intentionality of its own. That in fact every cell of the body is in some sense intentional. But it's just not intentional in the rational sense. It's a different kind of intentionality. And he goes as far as to suggest that the body has a consciousness of its own. and that it's that the functions of the body, and of course he's following partly Darwinian theory, 1859, Origin of Species is published, but of course Darwinian theory, as we know, or evolutionary theory, has been around for much longer. Darwin, in a sense, synthesizes ideas that have been around since at least the late 18th century. So there develops this idea that, in fact, the primary functions are not the mental functions. And Darwin, for instance, suggests that consciousness is a byproduct, as it were, of the other more vital bodily functions. And so there's almost a kind of reversal now in this period, in the 19th century, partly triggered by scientific rationalism, you know, or materialism rather, scientific materialism, but also partly by philosophical developments, that the body is now the more important agent, as it were, here, and the mind can only exist by, thanks to the body and its functions. And then someone like D.H. Lawrence, for instance, I mean, George, this is already present in George Eliot's writing, where there's a lot of sort of, there's depictions in Middlemarch of actions that occur seemingly without rational intention. And we see the characters wondering, well, you know, how did this happen? How did I come to, you know, how did I come to do this? There's a kind of unconscious or a bodily intentionality behind these actions. We get to someone like D.H. Lawrence, and for D.H. Lawrence, the body is the primary thing. It's what he calls first consciousness. And D.H. Lawrence coins this idea of what he calls blood consciousness. The blood functions as a kind of metaphor in Lawrence. It's not literally the blood, I think, but it's a metaphor for sensory, perceptual and other bodily functions. Instincts, for instance, are really important in Lawrence. But what Lawrence takes very seriously is the idea that there is a bodily consciousness. A number of critics say that this isn't true, that it's only even the idea of a bodily consciousness is a metaphor, but I think he's very serious about it, that the body has a kind of intentionality. And of course, I suppose, a sort of new idea that I've had, but one could even argue that, well, for someone like D.H. Lawrence, I mean, he's ill from about the age of 13 onwards. He ultimately dies of tuberculosis in 1930, I think it was, he dies. And tuberculosis, of course, is a kind of taboo in the period. There's no cure for it. There's no cure until 1946, when the combination antibiotic streptomycin is developed. And so he talks about his bronchioles, because, for instance, he couldn't have gone to a hotel as a sufferer of tuberculosis, because it was a contagious illness. And so I suppose what I'm saying here is that the body was never transparent for Lawrence, but always somehow foregrounded through illness, through the difficulty in breathing, through fatigue, through, in the end, emaciation, through illness. And one way of thinking about this is that the messages of the body, as it were, became a kind of language for Lawrence, as they do for Freud, actually. So for Freud, for instance, tics and convulsions and slips of the tongue and various kinds of things like that are not accidents, but they are the body speaking, in a way, speaking, to put it in quotation marks. And for Lawrence, I think illness becomes a kind of language of the body in the end, that signifies or that signals to us the various errors of our ways, or at least that's one way of thinking about it. The other positive expression of blood consciousness or blood wisdom is, of course, in Lawrence's sexuality, the instincts, the instinctual. He's not particularly interested in love, for instance. That doesn't mean much to him. He thinks this is a sort of conceptualization of something that doesn't need to be conceptualized, that is instinctual, spontaneous, and comes from the body rather than the mind.
Maybe I'll just follow up on that question. When I read your piece, I was struck by this tension between the psychic and then somatic, which actually appears in several pieces, Jean-Michel Suisse as well, and Josh Cohen's Psychoanalytic Buddies. Listening to you, I feel it's interesting because from the phenomenological point of view, or if one uses the phenomenological language, you have first this split between the mind and the body, and saying that basically from Conti's point of view, the body is the essential, the grounding, and it basically breaks the dualism between mind and body. But on the other hand, it claims that body has a consciousness, which is by itself a recuperation of the other side of the dualism. Okay. If you move to the psychoanalytic language, the picture is even less clear in the sense that what you call, for example, the body is not transparent or the unruly body, it precisely comes to a question that you cannot even decide which part of it is psychic and which part of it is somatic. See? So I think there's a slight shift, and because perhaps I'm more familiar with certain psychoanalytic, it's just very interesting for me the way you present it. And
I think Merleau-Ponty's idea is not dualistic at all. I think, on the contrary, it's the habitual body that mediates between the mind and the kind of somatic intelligence. Merleau-Ponty, I'll give you an example. Merleau-Ponty coins this idea of organic intentionality, by which he gives the example of when we're in a gallery and we look at a painting, we don't have to think about the optimum, each painting has an optimum distance from which it is best viewed, from which we see it sort of in the best possible perspective, as it were, or focus. But we don't have to consciously think about this. We can walk in a gallery and our body does this work for us. It focuses our eyes, puts us in front of exactly the right point from which to view the picture. And there are various other functions like this that the body does. And Merleau-Ponty has this notion of the phantom limb. He's writing Phenomenology of Perception during the Second World War. It's finished in 1945. So the phantom limb is something that people, that is a common experience. It's something that people are thinking about. And there's this mystery. How come if the nerves of the hand have been severed and the hand is no longer there, the subject still aims to reach at things with that hand and still feels pain in that hand? What's going on here? And this is how he comes to his point about the habitual body, that we have, every one of us has a body schema or a habitual body or a body image, which is the body as we experience it. And this experiencing body is precisely the body that also mediates between the mind and the body, as it were, so that consciousness is everywhere. Consciousness is in the hand, it's in the mind, it's we have memories. I mean, the phantom limb is a kind of embodied memory. That's what he's saying. It's my body, still retains that possibility that I used to have with this hand, and my body retains that memory of my abilities, my capacities, and that can take a long time to adjust, and it doesn't ever necessarily go away. So the fact that the body can have a memory, for instance, is already a sort of cognitive, a cognitive or a consciousness of its own. But it's not a dualistic idea.
But he is interested, as opposed to somebody like Lacan, he is interested in ultimately the knowing of the body itself.
He is, okay? That's right,
and the knowing of it through language. I think Merleau-Ponty contributed greatly to the split, to to correct the Cartesian tradition, if you like.
Sure.
But Lacan's critique of Merleau-Ponty would be precisely his, and Jean-Michel actually wrote about it, my first introduction on the subject was through Jean-Michel's piece on Lacan and Merleau-Ponty. And maybe we could. How do you see this question of the psychic and the somatic, and in relation to phenomena?
Just go back to Freud, because what we have with Freud, maybe it's the beginning of psychoanalysis, is his rereading of Charcot's treatment of hysteria.
That's right.
See, because you were talking about Broca, and Charcot followed and was trying to see the kind of brain location that hysteria would be a neurological disease, whereas Freud, who we know went to Paris for 2 years and studied with Charcot, pointed out what Charcot had already seen, but surprisingly, he didn't stop there and was still trying to find the brain, the spot in the brain somehow.
But what
Charcot was presenting with all those men and women who were hysterics was to show that their bodies that were at times paralyzed or they would be blind and they had all those symptoms were in fact, and at least this is how Freud understood it, linguistic embodiments. That when somebody's unconscious was saying, I can't stand it, they had to fall, or a pain in the neck, and the neck was paralyzed, or I can't see that, and they became blind. And so it's not, of course, a total discovery, but it's the combination of a certain literature. And I think a number among the authors here go back to that literature, mostly fin de siècle, 19th century, of the diseased body that speaks, also a certain theory. And here I would agree with you, perhaps, in Josh Cohen's essay, which is very interesting, there is a certain rapid dismissal of Lacan as being too much on the side of the signifier as signifier. Whereas in my little essay here, that's one of the things I discovered, and I have to thank you for putting me on the right track, that the first person who used the binary signifier-signified to talk about psychoanalysis was not Lacan, but Jean-Paul Sartre in the essay on emotions from 1932. Sartre, who opens the door but then closes it very quickly to the unconscious, uses exactly those terms signified to talk about how the body in terms of emotions, and this is I have to thank Ulrika because I had forgotten that she had assigned my topic on affects in that collection, but working on affects you realize that you are in fact dealing with a slightly more modern, in my case, Deleuzian terminology to talk about issues of both aesthetics and emotions and passions. There's a long discourse about that. But I did was somehow a way of connecting Deleuze and Lacan. That was the aim of my paper, to show that they don't disagree. I didn't use, for instance, a concept in Deleuze that I could have started from, which baffles me a little bit, the body without organs. And I don't mention it, I think.
No.
But I tried to work with What is Philosophy? And the last chapter in which Deleuze defines literature as the creation of affects. And what connects Deleuze and Lacan fundamentally is Spinoza. Spinoza's central question about, you know, in the ethics, what can a body do? And fundamentally, for Spinoza already, the body expresses. And in Deleuze, as some of you may know, there's a whole philosophy of expressions, a book, very good book on Spinoza, but also in Lacan. In his dissertation, Lacan was a Spinozist, and somehow he agrees with Deleuze about this issue of affect. And so there's a lot that has been written in the last 15 years on affect. Mm-hmm. And generally people like Brian Massumi and so on who work on affect theory are Deleuzians, real Deleuzians. I'm not a real Deleuzian. Mm-hmm. I like Deleuze, but I'm not a real Deleuzian. Mm-hmm. And they think that what they write is totally antagonistic to Lacanian psychoanalysis. Mm-hmm. And I try to show that, in fact, it says exactly the same. And I notice in Lacanian psychoanalysis, very recently, Soler and many others are now working on Lacanian affects. See? So, which is simply perhaps another way of talking about the discourse on passions that you might have with Descartes and so on. But it finds, at least this is what Deleuze and Guattari do so well, expression in literature and art. Mm-hmm. Not just literature, but art generally. And I was so interested in reopening the long debate. What brought me to Deleuze was simply when I taught a section of in class of the essay on affect, the chapter on affects, I realized that the translator hadn't gone back to a text by Edith Wharton and had retranslated the French, and it was totally incomprehensible. It was just this idea, well, let's see what they are really studying, the little short story by Edith Wharton that I found so important to understand Deleuze's conception of affect. I don't want to talk too much about that, but it is indeed the question that Yue was asking earlier on about psychoanalysis as, I think, a certain discourse in which you have the body and the body that speaks somehow, which is where we are at. And what does it mean to say that the body speaks? Is it a catachresis? What kind of language is that?
Yeah.
And how can, you know, our work as critics contribute to the understanding of what it means to say the body speaks?
That's right. Well, I think, and someone like D.H. Lawrence, for instance, though he didn't like Freud, he was influenced by these ideas. I mean, he had many Freudian friends and psychoanalytic friends, or friends who were psychoanalysts, and so he was permeated with these ideas. Of course, also his partner, Frieda, knew about Freud, and so, you know, you can see Freud's influence there very clearly, and not just in a crude way, but precisely in this way of the expressive speaking body, that is then also there in Joyce, it's also there in Beckett, it's in a sense one can find it everywhere in modernism, because that's the period, you know, it's the turn of the century, precisely when this idea emerges that there is a body that speaks. And of course it's also the you know, idea behind sexology, as we know from Foucault.
But maybe modernists, the modernist writers and many authors here discuss Beckett or Joyce or Woolf, have that simplifying idea that they are the first to talk about the body.
Yeah, maybe.
You know, like Joyce wanting to know what happened, you know, how can one describe Bloom's defecation? As you may know, this is what shocked people most. Not the sexual passages, but the fact that one can describe a hero on the stool and describe what it feels like to defecate.
In quite minute detail.
And indeed, this couldn't be done in a 19th century classical novel.
But here again, I mean, phenomenology comes into this, because phenomenology develops about the same time as modernist literature. So around 1900, I mean, this with Husserl's, you know, And you know, both are interested in first-person experience, precisely. So there are all kinds of things that the two have in common. And I suppose, in many ways, the modernist method is including stream of consciousness, is looking at various kinds of first-person experiences, and is phenomenological, if you like. Mm-hmm. Not only that, but that is one of the aspects.
Right. I mean, so if I can say, again, something that I tried, and I really just touched on it very briefly. Mm. What I liked in Deleuze and his philosophy of the body, you might say, is that he tries to posit affects that are not psychological or subjective.
That's right.
And that's very interesting, that a work of art for him, a novel, a painting, posits an affect, but this affect has nothing to do. This is why he likes Wolf, who is so good because, as we know, she was a borderline case herself in her life. And she sees, you might say, the exteriority of life and subjectivity, whereas Joyce is always, I would say, in a sense, closer to a certain psychologization via of literature, you know, Bloom. Of course, Bloom defecates, but he's also worried that he might be cuckolded, and he is, by his wife.
Yeah, he's anxious.
So he's anxious.
Novel,
so, and that's not what interests Deleuze.
No,
it's much more the possibility of saying, like certain characters of Wolf, that you see life outside as a sort of abstract and concrete affect that is out there at the same time.
Perhaps this, I can jump in to talk about perhaps George Cohen's piece, Listening to You, because I'm personally very interested in this article, because he departing from Freud's exclusion of actual neurosis, and I think he's talking about things like anxiety, neurosis, hypochondria, but also masochism. These things are, according to the author, that they are, they're excluded, they fail to enter the psychic sphere, but they've actually proved to be very important in modern literature, and especially decadent literature. So he gives examples of like Baudelaire and French decadent author Huysmans. And so he said these writers venture to the outermost limits of body and mind in the hope of finding some ultimate consummation that forever eludes, only to find themselves more deeply entrenched in feelings of ennui and dissatisfaction. So this kind of very enclosed circle of, it's almost the opposite. What interests me in this piece is that somehow there is some part, there is abyss of, or the impossibility of representation. We try to understand something, but only fall back on the more profound ennui, or in the case of Huysmans, he also talks about the mineral paysage, something which brings back to, I think this is the link that I was going trying to hoping to make with you, because you did mention in your article, Jean-Michel, from what you just said, you emphasize the part on philosophy of expression, but there is the other side, which is you call the objectivist anti-humanism. It's in there, and there is actually a switch in the essay, what I found very interesting. You, if I could just summarize your essay very quickly. In the first, you know, your theoretical point is Deleuze's last chapter of What is Philosophy? In English, I think it's called Precept, Affect, and Concept. And basically, you're arguing that you first analyzed the Edith Wharton story, The Verdict, and then later on you moved to Virginia Woolf. But first, you wanted to argue that affects, in a way, they become autonomous. Once you create, they don't belong to a subject anymore. They become autonomous, and they become autonomous especially in art. That's basically the story of Edith Wharton, but that it's a very Deleuzian approach between art and life. But that is in the second half of your essay, Jean-Michel, you moved to something else in which I would qualify as the absence of man, actually, in Virginia Woolf. This autonomy of eternity of affects, in fact, shifted. It's related, but shifted more and more towards the missing self in Virginia Woolf. Do you want to talk a little bit about
that? Yeah, I mean, it would be simple, and I didn't want to appear too Lacanian in that piece. Mm-hmm. But what I think Deleuze is pointing to is what Lacan would call the real as the place of the body. And so if one looks at the later Lacan, is always insisting on this idea that can strike one as a little paradoxical, that writing is on the side of the real, and that the thing, Zizek made a lot about the thing and so on, but it's an important concept for Lacan. The thing is not just the horror of the unnameable monstrosity and so on, but it is also where art and literature can be. And this is why they are so interesting for us, or can catch us, not because they talk to the symbolic of culture or the imaginary of the personal fantasies, but because it pushes us to that domain that by definition is almost impossible to explore, which is that of the real. I had the impression, and now that you asked me to explain a little more, that Deleuze, and maybe pushed by Guattari, was trying to define affects not just as emotions or the expression of emotions, but a sort of autonomous real that would be something that constitutes a certain body as art. Like it could be a sculpture, could be a painting, could be a musical piece, but it touches us because of the affect. And so the affect is what affects the audience, but as such it is detachable from the author or the personality of the author. Is that your sense?
Yeah, I agree. But if they're not emotions, what are they? They're beings, right? I mean, Deleuze would certainly use the word being. What are they? And what is being?
Well, you know, it's this old question that you find, I mean, you mentioned Darwin. Darwin is, I think, the last book is extraordinary for our
country. You mentioned it in your essay, that's right.
I think I'm not the only one to mention Darwin.
No, I think it occurs.
The question Darwin is always asking is, do humans express themselves in the same way as animals do? And he has an extraordinary chapter on blushing.
So
that maybe blushing is the only purely human thing, but I'm sure that we'll find animals that blush.
Change color, at least.
But anyway, apart from that, he's trying to find a sort of universal gamut of expression in which the smile can be about anger, protection, and also saying, please don't hurt me, or I'm with you, and so on. And he's also looking at some point at Lessing, famous Laocoon, that was asking a very important question, when is it that a body is monstrous and cannot be represented? That was the question of Lessing when he was discussing Laocoon. How can you represent a scream, and I think today we still have that kind of question, even though it's not about scream, but can we represent mutilated bodies and so on? What is the limit of representation and expression?
Shall we
maybe we could
open to the audience if you have questions. If not, as you can see, we can continue our conversation, but maybe some of you want just clarification, since I know we are talking about a whole collection. It's not out yet in the US.
It so is.
I thought, okay. Yeah. Anyway, you haven't seen it. I thought it was only in the UK.
No, it is already. Okay.
But if you have questions, please don't hesitate to ask. Yes.
Actually, I had a question before you were asking. I was curious to hear maybe more about maybe the tension between your approach and the nomological one, because you started with your questions by picking up on some of the vocabulary, very Bataille vocabulary, the vocabulary of kind of these excesses and things left out, base materialism, a kind of abject tradition. And there's a difference definitely between the idea of bringing the body to speech in literature and literature as moving towards a writing in the real, right? And Bataille, Blanchot as well, are both people who sort of endlessly thought this over. So I'm curious if you could talk more about Ulrika was talking about the phantom limb. She brought up the notion of the possibility, right? The intentionality and the horizon of possibility. And if you could talk about sort of impossibility and Bataille and impossibility and the way that that figures the relationship between art, literature, and the body. Because my sense is that they're very different, but I'm curious what you have to say.
Oh, it's a very big question, but I was, because Ulrika was talking so much about Merleau-Ponty, I mean, I already said it, and I think Merleau-Ponty is somebody so indispensable, you know, in phenomenology to basically made us rethink about body, not as on the upside of the spirit or the mind, but kind of has an inclusive or mediating relation to the mind. But listening to you and listening to Jean-Michel, I think perhaps the difference, I hesitate to pronounce sentences like that, between the psychoanalytical approach or the pieces that that immediately kind of put me, interested me, let's say, were the pieces that they question even the possibility of the body of knowing yourself. Because when you talk about the consciousness of the body and the intention of the body, you suppose that the body has an intention and has a consciousness. Those are already phenomenological vocabulary. It's not that I have anything against it. I think it's perfect, you know, in terms of history of philosophy and so on. But the switch or the displacement to psychic and somatic, what draws me that tension that I brought up in that tension is precisely you can decide which part is somatic and which part is psychic. In the case of Georges Bataille, we know, I mean, I worked a lot on that. He suffers from precisely neurotic anxieties, you know? Like, seriously, people doesn't say it enough. And hence all the tears, all the self-flagellations, so there's a desperate need to write about all these things, but he cannot control. In a way, it's beyond the question of intention. It's close to something what we would call, he would call the limited experience, you know, trying so desperately to get a hold of your own body and to understand it, but you only find it impossible. So this is something that of great intensity that interests me personally.
Perhaps I could add to this as well, that I suppose these traditions aren't as different as they might seem from this vocabulary, in a sense that when Merleau-Ponty talks about this kind of intentionality, it's a pre-reflective intentionality, as it were. It's not available to the conscious mind. And he gives the idea of, the example of reflexes, for instance, that, you know, the mind isn't in any way involved in reflexes. So in a sense, you know, there's a kind of, I mean, it's an anti-rationalism, and it is a kind of post-humanism in some sense, that the, you know, the kind of, you know, all masterful subject has gone, and there's something else has taken its place. And so in that sense, I don't see these two, I don't see Bataille and Merleau-Ponty necessarily as antithetical thinkers. But I suppose what I would say is that Merleau-Ponty is more affirmative than Bataille. Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, and someone like Samuel Beckett is a good example, again, of this not being able to master or control or know, or this body that seems to be out of control, that seems to be unruly. He has this play called Not I from 1972, which is about a character. You can't call it character, it's a player. Beckett stopped calling his performers character, or his entities, characters, but rather players. A player that is a mere mouth. And so the stage version has a mere mouth, literally, on the stage with a spotlight on it. There's a television version which just has a mouth on the screen, and there's nothing else. And this mouth is spewing out language, and is spewing out language in a way that is incomprehensible. We're not meant to understand what mouth is saying, merely see this kind of, on the one hand, physical labor of producing language. So the mouth is opening, closing, we can see the tongue and the teeth participating, we can see the spittle flying out of the mouth in the spotlight. So it's about the materiality of language. But on the other hand, it's about precisely that materiality taking over in a way. It's about the idea that language speaks us, that we aren't necessarily in control of language. It's about the fact that this character called Mouth has lost all control, all sense of intention here. And language is the kind of intentional agent in a kind of weird kind of way, and is speaking itself here, machinically. So that again is about not being able to do. That's about the limits of what, you know, my so-called subject. It's a different kind of form of subjectivity now. And if we think of someone like Deleuze, for instance, he has this notion of the molecular. And the molecular is most, I suppose, one example of the molecular would be in his famous essay, Becoming Animal. And Deleuze favours pack animals, rats and wolves and animals like that. He favours them because they function as a group, as a kind of, the group becomes a kind of unified organism. And what he doesn't, and rather than a self, there is no self there anymore. There is only the pack. And the self is always the kind of source of all evil in Deleuze. This is the kind of aspiration, as it were. This is what the molecular is about these animals functioning not as cells, but as a pack.
I loved your question about Bataille and the impossible, and one needs to go back to his wish to stick to the impossible and not to make the impossible possible, precisely. And so Bataille, for instance, would have very little to do with a wayward disciple of Freud like Grodek, who was all, you know, who wrote this the book of the id, and for whom everything in the body is expression, and so if you have a problem, you are constipated, and you make the body speak to cure the body. With Bataille, there's this notion that the body is also an interruption, like obscenity, vomit, laughter, excess, so it has to be a certain excess. And this is really the function of the body here, not in a sense of a taming of the body by making the body speak along like psychosomatic lines, but as something very, very foreign and disruptive.
It is base materialism, that's what
exactly.
It is. Yeah.
Exactly. Any other question?
Yes, this is. I find this very interesting, the discussion. And of course, it's difficult to ask questions when you haven't read the book. But I think there are some basic issues that come up in the discussion and maybe need some clarification. And that's sort of the tension between the unified bodily subject and some kind of dichotomy. Because I think that what needs to be clarified, at least for me, is what happened to the Cartesian tradition of the body and mind split in your theoretical approach. Is it all sort of done away with through a Merleau-Ponty kind of phenomenology? Because I think that what I miss in those sort of very rational approaches to the totality of the body, also in its brain quality, is maybe a historical dimension, an historical awareness. And I don't think that "not I" is a language that is not understandable. It's language which needs a very meticulous form of deciphering, just maybe like the dreams that Freud tries to interpret. They come from somewhere, but they don't necessarily come from the body. And this I see between the two of you there a kind of implicit tension where maybe it's not possible to thread on the dichotomy, but the dichotomy somehow remains, even in very contemporary literature. I wouldn't say always in philosophy, but you're talking about literature. Yeah. Not about philosophy, not about neuroscience. Neuroscience is very imperialistic in this way.
Is very what?
Imperialistic.
But this was more, well, but my essay historicizes that moment, really. But just to go back to the Beckett first, because that came last. Beckett's own direction of the play was to have the language spewed out so fast that it works, and this is a quotation, on the nerves of the audience, not its intellect. And Alan Schneider, who first directed the play in America, wrote to Beckett in 1972 and said, "What am I supposed to do, you know, with this play? What is it about? And you know, what am I supposed to make of Mouth's monologue?" And Beckett wrote back and said, "It's a purely buccal phenomenon."
But you don't have to trust the author always.
No, well, that's true. But that's the way it's been usually staged. And I suppose that is one way of thinking about it. On the other hand, one could think of Mouth, say, as a hysteric, or whether there are various kinds of readings. I'm not saying that. But Beckett was very interested in Tourette's syndrome. He read Max Nordau's Degeneration, the 1895 translation, and he took notes on coprolalia and echolalia. So coprolalia is, Beckett put in brackets, muck talk. So it's the spewing out, the not entirely unintentional, because the subject has to know what an obscenity is, as it were, to be able to spew it out, and what is going to be offensive in a certain kind of context to be able to utter it in the first place. But in Tourette's, there's only partial control. Tourette's is a bit like, I suppose, peristalsis, that there is only partial control of these utterances, that these utterances and the motor tics can be suspended, but they can't be done away with altogether. And so Beckett's interested in this Touretic notion of language, I suppose, of language that escapes intention, precisely. But now the earlier question was that, there are a number of essays that deal with the Cartesian. So there's Cartesian question, which is touched upon in medieval somatics. Of course, this is pre-Descartes. Predates Descartes, but it's about the sort of dualism. It's also talked about in David Hillman's essay, Staging Early Modern Embodiments. So Descartes keeps coming up, and this idea of there isn't just a phenomenological idea of the body in this book, there are other kinds of philosophical notions of the body as well. But I suppose we all, we David and I both had an interest in the body, that the body that appears in literature and the ways in which the body appears in literature, and I suppose our sympathies are with a kind of post-human or phenomenological body, if you like. I mean, I'd just like to stress that phenomenology does grow out of the same moment as post-structuralism. You know, they have the same origin. So I think to think of phenomenology as some kind of sort of outdated humanism is too limited an approach to phenomenology. There's much more to it than that.
And maybe to go back to Freddie's excellent question, with Beckett and maybe Deleuze, one can start questioning this idea of a Cartesian dualism. That in fact, if one looks at Descartes more closely, like Beckett, who had read Descartes very well.
He wrote his MA thesis about Descartes.
For instance, Beckett was always interested in the conarium, the pineal gland, which is so funny in French, but he has certain characters called conaires Mercier, and so on.
But and Murphy is a Cartesian parody.
That's it. But if you look at Descartes' texts, Descartes wrote much more on the body than he said. Of course, in the Meditations, he has that dualism that's totally strategic, but Beckett was quite aware that he had written a treatise on de fetu, on the fetus, on generation. He was interested in blood and optics and so on. So there's an entire discourse of the body and the passions, discourse on passions. And if you twist a little bit Descartes from a Deleuzian perspective, even if you agree, I mean, that there is something like the machine and the soul, for Deleuze, this is perfect. The machine is where you have the dynamism, and you can have a Deleuzian Descartes. It works perfectly well.
But and also even something like the sixth meditation, you know, Descartes is himself doubting his own sort of theory, and he's thinking, well, wait a minute, it's difficult to think about this body-mind thing because we don't just inhabit our bodies as a sailor inhabits a ship, and we don't just steer the body. It's more complicated than that. And he begins to kind of ponder over this. And of course, just to go back to Beckett, Beckett wrote his poem Horoscope, which is on Descartes. It's a poem on the subject of time, and it's had to be under 100 lines, and it was his first independently published work, and it's all about Descartes and, I suppose, partly about modernity, about scientific ideas, about Copernicus, and about William Harvey's circulation of blood and things like that.
Yeah, but for instance, the point of departure of this really funny poem is that Descartes liked omelettes for breakfast, but they had to be from eggs that had been 8 or 10 days under the hen, which means that these eggs were not just as normal eggs that we eat thinking innocently pure abortions, but they were already with a little bird visible. So that's
crunchy
also
eggs.
A certain solution about the body-mind problem.
Yes.
Of course, the result must have been totally disgusting for us, but still, it complicates the idea that you can eat an egg just like that.
Yeah.
Because the text in Beckett, which goes much further, I think, than Not I, is the monologue by Lucky in Waiting for Godot, which is exactly that kind of.
Yeah, pathological speech,
quack.
Yeah, it's a kind of, yes, exactly. In spite of the tennis.
any other question or to explain or develop any issue here?
First question.
I guess I'm still sort of interested in the point you make about phenomenology, but maybe that's best.
In a different direction, you talked about how the volume historicizes the body, but of course literature is also something that has to be historicized as well.
Yeah.
And there's something very different between the concept of literature as a medium of simulation, of sensory simulation.
Yeah, no, that was in Stephen Connors.
Right, in a specific
essay. About, he uses literature as a kind of, well, he argues that literature is the model for all other media, really.
Right,
that
yeah.
simulate the senses.
So I'm curious, it's a question more just like about the book, about how that's dealt with, because, there are a lot of writers, like I'm thinking of Friedrich Kittler in particular, mm-hmm. someone who's very particular about locating the way in which language functions in specific contexts.
Yeah.
So that there's something very different about, you know, a Mallarmé poem from Novalis' piece. And I'm thinking specifically of this example that he gives, and it's just fresh in my head because I just read the book, of this piece Rilke wrote. It was an essay he wrote where he said that like to truly make art would be to basically run a gramophone needle along the coronal suture of the skull. To read what had never been written. So I guess, yeah, I'm curious about how the book deals with these questions of the historicity of what we mean by literature.
Well, it tries to cover various periods of literature. So it goes from medieval to Renaissance to 18th century, 19th century. There's a chapter on Romanticism, the chapter on language and the body, even though it's a post-structuralist analysis, is actually on Romantic literature. And then goes through 19th century literature, a number of essays, and all the way to post-human bodies. So it tries to do that at the same time as it sort of introduces various theoretical stances. I mean, it tries to look at the ways in which embodiment is reimagined in different periods at the same time as it's looking at the literary examples. So, if that makes any sense. Does that answer your question? I'm not sure it does.
I'm curious about the book, but also about just your thoughts on that, particularly like sort of in the present or in the 20th century, what is like kind of the concept of literature that, you know, works with the body?
What is? Well, I suppose there's many different kinds of literatures that work with the body, but when I talked about modernism and phenomenology, again, I see modernism as opposed to humanism, if you like, you know, if that makes any sense. I see the very reversal, in a sense, of hierarchy, you know, between the body and the mind, even though it's an embodied mind, but, you know, that the body becomes primary in a way. It's an anti-rationalism. It's a tradition of thinking that we can trace back to people like Kleist, for instance, and others. I don't think there's just one way of portraying the body. But I do think that, especially in modernism, it becomes really, really prominent because of all these ideas. I mean, all kinds of things, you know, increasing secularization, Darwinism, Freud. Freud is really crucial here. Various scientific discoveries, not just Broca's, not just Charcot's. There's this question of, you know, contingency as well. So, I mean, for Charcot, bodily events are contingent events, really. And so Charcot and his various followers, but not Freud, talks about agency and free will as pure metaphysical constructs. So, and pure sort of, as it were, metaphysical correlates for the soul, or a notion of the self. But I suppose when Freud begins to read symptoms, the body becomes, you know, the intentionality shifts in a sense. Okay, this is slightly, I'm simplifying here, and you two can come into this afterwards. But intentionality shifts in his true intentionality, the real kind of speaking, shifts to the body rather than the mind. So it's the body now that tells the truth, as it were, that begins to speak. What the mind, you know, with all its repressions and things, can no longer easily express. So that's again. So all of these things are really, really crucial in the 20th century, and they all influence 20th century thinking.
I think in all our discussion and the way we pitch questions or answer to them, we have to be attentive to grammatical issues, like when we say the body.
Mm.
Can one say the body?
Yeah, exactly.
Or
yeah.
Could we say bodies? Mm. One name that was not really much mentioned in the you could not do everything. Who is that of Roland Barthes? And you have worked a lot on Barthes, because the later Barthes will not use the body, but my body.
Mm.
So my body is Barthes' rereading of Nietzsche, and the question is, what does this question say to me in my singularity now? Because my body now is not the same as my body last year, or in 20 years, we age, and so on. And so it's a way of being completely in not the present, but in a certain singularity. So my body will not react like your body, and so on. And so here we have to be careful.
Yes,
can there
absolutely.
Be the body a transhistorical object or not? Is it totally historicized? I think you would say it is historicized from the point of view here.
Well,
but how much is it a plurality?
It's a plurality.
Or a singularity?
It's a plurality, even within one single person's experience, as Roland Barthes shows. Absolutely, but also, you know, we've got essays on racialized bodies, and it would be, you know, preposterous to say that all bodies, that there is the body, as it were. No, bodily experience is always singular, yeah.
Maybe I'd like to come back to Fred's question, which I think is a very good question, and actually that's one of the questions that I had myself. In a way, our debate or tension, it's a fake one, because when I read the whole book, I was not even aware of the so-called phenomenological approach.
No, it's not
only because we discussed it right before that, and you told us a little bit about the origin of the book, that the subject came up. But your question was that I felt the answer is your question about what about the Cartesian dualism, is it done away? And you said no. And I felt it was a yes and no, because precisely it's as if theoretically you still have to justify some kind of anti-rationalist stance. But in fact, in all the essays, including the essays that the medieval, you know, if you look at the content of this essay by Bill Bergwinkel, he talks about medieval somatics. Maybe because I'm Bataillon, but I note a theme of flagellation, tears, limited experience, body suspended. It's another way of writing. It's a story about a saint, but it's another way. It's already quite post-human, I don't know, but it gives the body the primacy. It lets the body speak. And so I think what's interesting is somehow theoretically perhaps there's still some kind of need to justify, but in fact, here's where literature comes in. In literature, the body speaks, the body cannot control itself, and the body does not even seek to know truly about itself. And perhaps I think that's the power of the collection. And I was going to originally, but I was very sensitive to all this, how come this, what I would call a negative, but actually it's not, depiction of the body, like almost close to the abject or the aging, the decaying, the illness, the stability and all that. But this is something that interests me as well as an author, that you do a collection of essays and you don't really know what would come out. I mean, the coherence of it, actually, it would be only perceived by a reader. In a way, when you produce a book, the original intention of the book actually does no longer belongs to you. And I think for each of us, we'll probably perceive it differently. And I think in that case, it's...
Sure. Yes, and I suppose I should clarify that the intention was by no means to produce a book of phenomenology. And as I say, and as you say, there's almost no phenomenology in the book, actually. But I suppose that that's been one of the things that has led me to the body, I should say, I suppose, or to these various bodies. One interesting thing about Bill Bergwinkle's essay on medieval somatics is precisely how much medieval somatics has in common with something like post-human bodies, you know, so that there, you know, it shows us that literature has always had the ability to be anticipatory or to imagine itself beyond its kind of more narrow cultural context, perhaps, or in every period, really, so that one can trace continuities as well as changes and divergences between these different periods. That literature is always the space, I mean, this is what Derrida says, it's the space where that which can't be imagined anywhere else, which can't be articulated, can't be spoken of, can be spoken of. And that includes these really complicated, sometimes difficult, very negative, sometimes sexually explicit, various other things, experiences. But literature is a space where they can be, where the inadmissible, as it were, and various other things can be articulated.
I mean, it's an idea that the Russian critic Mikhail Bakhtin had put forward quite a long time ago by taking the theme of the body in literature. One is forced to realize that the chronologies have to go back further in time and that if the body seems to appear much more prominently in modernist and modern periods, one cannot forget that there is a long cultural repression of the body, but that in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, and if we go back to Petronius, Apuleius, and the Latin novelists and the Greek novelists, the body, I mean, think of Satyricon, the body is there all the time, not just Fabio and so on. And so what we take as, say, for the novel or the theater as a paradigm is in fact just a very short period that is the bourgeois moment of expression, you might say, with the novel particularly. But if we today we are going back to very, very ancient models in which the bodies, I mean not the body, but bodies as a multiplicity and really teeming metamorphic multiplicity reappear in our culture. I think that's something that the collection shows very well. Because there is indeed, we begin with the medieval body and we end here with the post-human, prosthetic body, and so on. But in fact, they say very similar things.
Very similar things, which is, that's right.
So, so one of the things that interests me personally, I don't want to, but maybe just last short question, precisely on this subject, that in your article, but in many, just to bring back to the post-human, how much I feel this is very much a book on body and literature, but in some essays, several essays, the question of asubjectivity keeps coming back. It's as if the body becomes fragmented or even dissolves itself in literature, because literature is this very, it's an all-inclusive possibility precisely for the body to not express as a body, but in French you have the partitif, the partial articles, but part of the body, you know. So I think it's It's but in Jean-Michel's essay, I was really interested by this idea that you bring up in Virginia Woolf's Mrs. Dalloway, I think you were analyzing, the idea of asubjective vitality. You can think externally and you can write not from inside yourself. So in the posthuman also in the sense that the subjectivity is no longer connected to an interior self, but you can actually have a double and think about yourself and your own body from the external point of view.
Mm.